Barry Sonnenfeld broke into the movie industry by working as the cinematographer on the Coen brothers' first three movies. He went on to direct The Addams Family, Get Shorty, and the first three installments of the Men in Black franchise. But before all this, Barry had to endure childhood and adolescence. And that wasn't easy with an overprotective mother constantly keeping tabs on him. He's written all about it in a book called Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, Memoirs of a Neurotic Filmmaker. And if you're wondering where the title comes from, that makes two of us. We zoomed in with Barry so he could explain.
Well, it was one of the more surreal moments of my life. I was at Madison Square Garden in 1970. I was a senior in high school. It was the first peace concert in New York. Peter, Paul, and Mary, the cast of Hair, all these other people. And at 2:20 in the morning, while Jimi Hendrix was warming up for the second time, because he had left the stage in a huff earlier, came the following announcement over the Madison Square Garden PA system: Barry Sonnenfeld, call your mother. It says so much about my mother. A, that she was that of a protective Jewish mother of an only child, that she could actually page me. And B, it shows how strong she was in her weakness to be able to find someone willing to actually answer the phone and agree there was something damn important going on that required me to call my mother. It goes downhill from there, by the way.
What was your reaction? Like, take me back to the moment when, you know, Hendrix is about to start playing and then you hear this announcement over the PA.
Well, so first of all, you start to cry uncontrollably because you realize the only reason that you would be page at Madison Square Garden is that your father has died. And therefore, I'm going to spend the rest of my life as a skinny virgin living at home with my overprotective mother. So also, by standing up, I have announced to Madison Square Garden that I indeed am Barry Sonnenfeld. So what starts in the cheap blue seats, which is where we were, but cascades down towards the red and orange, more expensive seats, is the Madison Square Garden chant of Barry, Barry. So now Jimmy has stopped. The garden is chanting Barry, and I am weeping uncontrollably. I get to the payphone. This is obviously before cell phones, or she probably would have texted me. And the next thing you know, I'm weeping, saying, who died? And Mom saying, well, I thought you did. You said you'd be home at 2, and it's 2:20. I, of course, said, yeah, but Mom, didn't they tell you the concert was still going on? And Mom said, well, yeah, they told me that, but they couldn't find you. So that was my mother, and therefore that's the title of my book.
Right. That speaks volumes about what your mother was like. But what else can you tell us about her and your relationship with her growing up?
Well, you know, she was very depressed. You know, she spent most of her time in her bedroom with a wet towel over her face. She told me that if I went to sleepaway school, others call it college, she would commit suicide. So I spent 3 years of living at home attending NYU. I realized, wait a minute, why don't I just go somewhere else for my senior year of college, and I'll get to both go away to college and my mother commits suicide. Two birds, one stone, win-win. So I spent my senior year at Hampshire College, and unfortunately, my mother reneged on her threat, so she remained a living entity in my life. But she was just very desperate for attention, and both my parents were very narcissistic.
Yeah. One of the things that caused a lot of conflict between you and your mother later in her life and in your life as well, you were saying that you wished your mother was dead during interviews. You'd say that like on Letterman and in an interview with the New York Times Magazine reporter. Why would you do that?
Well, no, I never said I wished my mother were dead on Letterman. On Letterman, what I said is that until he died, my mother could have been Vincent Gardenia's photo double. And of course, Letterman, because they pre-interview, had a photo of Vincent, and the camera zooms in on this photo of Vincent, and I looked at it and I said,
that my mother had more facial hair. And again.
So that was sort of devastating. And then when the Times came out, she said decimated. I said devastated. And she said, no, I'm decimated. But the worst, I think, really, was Newsweek, when Men in Black came out, had a cover story on Men in Black. And in the article, it said that I used to walk around the set offering anyone on the set, grips, electricians, camera people, wardrobe, $400,000 to either get me kicked off the movie or kill my mother. And so this was in Newsweek, and Mom called me and she said, Barry, do you really wish I were dead? And I said, you know what, Mom? I promise you, I would never pay anyone $400,000 to kill you. And she said, thank you, Barry. I love you too. But listen, I sound like I'm a horrible, horrible son. And I have to tell you, I was, but my parents deserved it. So there.
You have 9 words that you use to describe your personal philosophy. What are they?
It's regret the past, fear the present, dread the future. Let me give you some advice. There's no upside in being an optimist. And I'll give you an example. If when you get on an airplane, you turn to your wife and you say, I don't think we're going to make it. I think this plane's going to crash before we get to Cleveland. Either one of two things happen. If the plane starts to nosedive to the ground, you get to elbow your wife and say, hello, am I right or what? Which is a win. Or you land safely in Cleveland, which is also a win because you didn't die. Win-win.
Oh, absolutely. That's my philosophy, too. And I guess we should start a cult, although maybe we should call it a religion so that we can get the tax breaks. And what do you think? I think we should call it Sonnenfeldology. How does that sound to you?
Well, or you could say that it's a Sonnenfeldian concept. I like the phrase Sonnenfeldian.
Okay. Yeah, I like that, too. Let's go with that. You have way more street cred than me, so I'm going to defer to you. You broke into the film industry as the cinematographer on Joel and Ethan Coen's first 3 films, Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, and Miller's Crossing. How did you meet the Coen brothers?
I met Joel Coen at a Christmas party, and we were the only 2 Jews there. And we sort of could see each other from across the room and sense the Semitic nature of our being. We started to talk, and Joel said that he and his brother Ethan had written a script for a low budget movie called Blood Simple, and the way they were going to raise the $750,000 to make the movie was to shoot a fake trailer. Their theory was that if you're going to go to dentists and doctors and, you know, say we need $15,000 for a point, a doctor or a dentist can't read a script and know if it's any good. And they can't also read a script and say, okay, I guess you kids know how to direct. But if you shoot a trailer, all those investing clubs, you know, can look at that trailer and go, A, this looks like a good trailer, so they know what they're doing. And B, this looks like a trailer of a movie I'd go see. So I said to Joe, well, I own a 16mm movie camera. And Joe said, well, if you've got a camera, you're hired. So we went out, we shot the trailer, we loved the way it looked, and we became good friends. And the first day of shooting on Blood Simple was the first day that Joel, Ethan, or I had ever been on a movie set.
One of the most, if not the most iconic shots in Blood Simple actually appeared in the trailer that you made before the film. Can you tell us about this shot and how you accomplished it?
Well, we did it 2 ways. We did it 1 way in the trailer, which worked much better. And then when we shot it for real in Austin, it was not nearly as good. There's a scene where Fran McDormand's character has snuck into the room next door, and she's hiding in the bathroom. And the killer, played by M. Emmett Walsh, is in the next bathroom separated by a wall and a window, and Fran has slammed M. Emmett Walsh's hand down on a windowsill and put a knife through his hand, so Emmett is stuck there. So what Emmett's character does is takes his gun and starts shooting holes between the two walls. And he shoots so many holes that he's able to then smash his arm through the wall and remove the knife that's stuck in his hand. The way we did it for the trailer is we built a fake wall in Hillary Ney's loft. Hillary Ney was a woman who was having the Christmas party that Joel and I had attended. And we cut out big plugs and then filled them up again. So as the camera dollied towards the wall, there was a guy in the back behind this fake wall we built and would hit hammers into the plug, which would send the plugs through frame and reveal this bright beam of light. It worked great. When we did it for real, we had a real special effects guy instead of just Don, a guy with a hammer. And he set little charges in the wall, and that didn't work nearly as well as using the simple way. We always say that if we remade Blood Simple, we could do it for 20 times the budget and it would be half as good.
You made your directorial debut with the 1991 film, The Addams Family. What was the biggest challenge you faced as a first-time director?
Well, as a first-time director, the biggest challenge is working with actors. Because as a cinematographer, oftentimes the actors are those people that are less than helpful. But as a director, those are the people telling your story. So for me, the biggest challenge was, would I know what to say when an actor would say, why am I doing this? And for me, what I learned is if you just tell actors to talk really fast, that solves everything. It's true. The faster an actor talks, the less chance they have to act. And for me, I hate watching acting. I just like watching reality. So if an actor talks fast, it prevents them from stammering or taking times or reacting. So whenever I'm on the set, pretty much the only thing I'll ever say to an actor is, let's do it again, like twice as fast. When I'm directing two actors, the thing I say to them is after a take, I'll come up to them and I'll say, one of you was very good. And then I walk away, and they don't know which one I'm talking about, but boy, both of them try to do better.
In your book, you say that many books by successful authors are optioned before they're even published, which you hope is the case with your book, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. So I got to ask, has it been optioned?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Warner Brothers Television and Rob Reiner, who's a friend of mine, are in negotiation to option my book.
Awesome.
And we think it would be a very funny streaming show where you see how the past informs the present.
I hope that happens. And so who would you like to see play yourself and your mother? Would you play yourself?
No, I would want Max Greenfield to play me. He's a good-looking Jew, which would be fun. And unfortunately, because he's dead, we can't have Vincent Gardenia playing my mother.
Yeah, so who plays your mother?
I don't know, but we'll find an overweight, squat, hairy man to come in and play mom.
Yeah. Barry Sonnenfeld, thank you very much for the suitably Sonnenfeldian conversation.
Well, listen, this has been a total, total pleasure. I enjoy talking to you so much.
That was film director Barry Sonnenfeld. He's the author of Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, Memoirs of a Neurotic Filmmaker. Find out more about Barry at WPR.org/beta.
And I think that she gave voice to that, in many respects, a torch song singer. And that torchiness and its kind of long association with LGBT cultures is one of the reasons I find Karen Carpenter has such resonance in LGBT communities.
Author Karen Tongson joins us to talk about why Karen Carpenter matters. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.